From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
And the internet goes to the highest bidder? I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The FCC is proposing new rules that would create a two-tiered system for the internet, a faster tier for telecom giants who pay top dollar and a slower one for the little guys. Is the agency giving control over our access to information to corporate interests? Or might new regulations create a more competitive market and better service for consumers? Whatever happened to President Obama's promise of a free and open internet? We'll hear about pay-to-play broadband and how it might affect innovation and free speech. Also on today's Talking Point, Nigeria's lost girls. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
We're back with To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, federal regulators are unveiling a plan that would create fast and slow lanes for content on the internet. How would a pay-to-play broadband system affect innovation, consumers, and the philosophy that everyone has a right to equal access to the flow of information on the web? And on today's Talking Point, Nigeria's stolen girls. 2 weeks ago, Islamic militants known as Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 young women from a school. As of yet, the government hasn't rescued them. It's just one in a series of similar attacks on secular institutions there. And first, this news update. Iraqi voters headed to the polls today in the country's first parliamentary election since the U.S. troop withdrawal. Voters are choosing from among more than 9,000 candidates vying for just 328 seats. And the election comes amid escalating sectarian violence. More than 3,000 people have died in Iraq this year alone. Matt Bradley is the Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joins us from Baghdad. Welcome. Welcome, Matt.
Hi.
Hi there. How orderly?
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you? How did the election go today? How orderly or disorderly was it?
It was a relatively orderly election by Iraqi standards. There was very little violence. What we heard was that there were about four people, or what we know as of now, is that four people were killed in an attack north of Baghdad, and about 16 people were wounded. There were some other attacks throughout the country with no casualties reported, but as far as Iraqi standards go, and particularly as far as the standards of violence go recently over the last couple of months, this was a very peaceful election.
So, and do you credit that at all to the fact that Iraq military and officials voted on Monday, or is this just a lull?
Well, that's typical. That would be normally elections are run where the security services are given a separate day so that they can then devote their time to guarding the actual elections. I think this is simply a lull, and I think the security precautions that were taken, which were similar to what you would see in previous elections, they were simply effective this time. It's hard to predict exactly the ebb and flow of violence in Iraq. It's often connected more to local events than to global events or regional events.
So what are voters telling you about who they're voting for and what issues most concern them?
Well, it depends on the voter, and it increasingly in Iraq depends on the sect. When I was in a Shiite neighborhood here in Baghdad, I heard a lot of people saying that they were voting for Maliki, who has been the prime minister for the last 8 years, two terms, and now he's trying to run for another third term. And when I was in a Sunni district, a lot of people said that they were voting for Sunni lists or secular lists because they were opposed to Maliki. Some of the Shiite voters I spoke with were pushing for candidates who were even more sectarian than Maliki. There's a group called Asa'ib Ahl al-Haq, which is a militia organization that has joined the military in suppressing some of the Sunni Islamist extremists who have risen up in western Iraq and in some parts of northern Iraq. They're running on a list called the Sadiqun. And this list is essentially politicians who are connected to a militia organization. They're backing Maliki. But this is a vote toward a group that is essentially a Shiite militia. And so in many ways, some of these voters were telling me that they want to see an even stronger hand by some of the members of the public, by people who aren't in the security forces, to take on some of the Islamist militants.
And the issues driving these voters, what do they say about that?
Security, infrastructure? Security. This has constantly been an issue because the security issue dictates a lot of other successes and failures in the country. Of course, services are part of it, improving the economy. These are all important issues for Iraqis and for voters anywhere, but security forms the backbone of a change that a lot of people want to see in Iraq. So, like I said, in the areas where people were supporting Maliki, they said that Mr. Maliki had done a great job in fighting some of the Sunni Islamist extremists that had been rising up in Anbar. The people in some of the Shiite neighborhoods said that Maliki had done a bad job of fighting these people, and that he had made matters worse by increasing sectarianism and inflaming anger among the Sunni minority.
And in places where recent fighting has been intense, Fallujah and Ramadi, for example, are there any news? Is there any news on whether Iraqis in those cities voted?
Well, there really wasn't any voting in Fallujah. Fallujah is out of bounds from the Iraqi government, so they didn't even really attempt to set up voting booths there. There was some voting in Ramadi, but really a lot of the voting from those places was done outside. There were about 80 polling stations that were set up just for internally displaced people from Fallujah and Ramadi in places where a lot of these refugees have congregated, North Iraq and the area around Kurdistan, and in places like Karbala, which is south of Baghdad. In these places, some of the refugees were able to cast their ballots when they weren't able to do so in Fallujah and Anbar, in Anbar province. And, despite that this was a voting day and this was a very crucial day for security in Iraq, we didn't hear of any major attacks in Anbar.
Matt Bradley is the Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much. When we come back, how the FCC's proposed net neutrality rulebook could change the internet. So stay with us for that conversation on To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney. On May 15th, the Federal Communications Commission is scheduled to announce new rules for the internet. The agency wants to allow large broadband companies like Verizon or Comcast to pay a higher rate for faster data transmission. Internet activists say that this two-tiered internet system amounts to a body blow to a long-cherished philosophy of net neutrality. And that's the idea that all data on the web, you know, your movies, music, articles, and radio shows, should be allowed to flow from data servers to you, the user, without discrimination by network middlemen. Gautam Nagesh covers the FCC and tech policy for The Wall Street Journal. And hi, good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, why is the agency promoting this? What's wrong with the way the system works now?
So basically, the FCC says that there are currently no rules that would prevent your ISP from either blocking or slowing down specific websites or services that they don't like for any reason.
And that's Internet Service Provider, ISP.
Yes, sorry, broadband providers, exactly. Because the federal court threw out the FCC's previous net neutrality rules in January. So right now, it's basically the Wild Wild West. And broadband providers don't have any restrictions on what they can do. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler says that the approach he has put forward would be the best and quickest way to ensure that broadband providers can't pick and choose websites. Of course, it has prompted, I think it's fair to say, a fierce debate over whether or not this is the appropriate approach.
And just briefly, we have Democratic Congresswoman Anna Eshoo on soon to join us, but explain for us what this two-tiered internet plan is.
Well, so yes, exactly. The FCC says that what their rules would do is ban any broadband provider from either blocking or slowing down specific websites. However, they would allow the broadband providers to strike deals with content companies, what we call edge providers, for some sort of special treatment. That could be faster access, or that could be prominent placement somehow on the home screen or something to that effect. But what it really means is that there would be preferential treatment in some fashion available to companies. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler today out in Los Angeles at the cable show, he says that he will not allow the internet to be separated into haves or have-nots. So their rules are going to mandate that broadband providers keep providing what we currently consider, you know, an adequate service, what we use to watch Netflix and use voice over IP telephones and that sort of thing. So it's not really clear what the division will be like, but we do know there will be opportunities for special treatment, and that has advocates of net neutrality up in arms.
Well, it seems like a moving target, right? You broke this story in the Wall Street Journal that these rules were coming on the 15th, and now we're in this, a public comment period? Is this the FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler trying to deal with the scoop?
Well, I think yes, and to some degree, whether or not it's our report, the New York Times also ran both an editorial sort of slamming this move and some stories really questioning the FCC's tact. Some people are portraying this as the FCC and President Obama going back on their pledge to protect net neutrality. If you consider net neutrality to mean the idea that all internet traffic should be treated equally, then yes, this does not seem to meet that definition. However, we have been reporting since at least February that this was likely to happen, that whatever path the FCC took was going to probably include some sort of paid preferential treatment avenue. And that's because the federal court has made it pretty clear that unless the FCC decides to reclassify broadband service as a public utility, which would make it open to much greater regulation, including possibly price controls, then they can't try to enforce net neutrality without really stirring up some legal problems and leaving themselves open to a court challenge.
Gautam Nagesh covers the FCC and tech policy for the Wall Street Journal. Anna Eshoo joins us now. She's Democratic Congresswoman representing Silicon Valley, and she's the ranking member of the Communications and Technology Subcommittee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, what's your opinion on the FCC's pay-to-play proposal?
Well, clearly there are in this latest round of proposed net neutrality rules, I think that there are two things. I think that internet service providers not being able to block online content and be transparent in their network practices, I think that that is good. I've always supported it. I'd like to see it put into place, honored, and everyone's feet held to the fire on it. But what the FCC chairman proposed as a legal standard that would allow the FCC to approve, quote, commercially reasonable agreements between online content companies and broadband providers for faster internet speeds is, I really have high fears and deep doubts about how that is going to turn out, I think it opens the door because they are ambiguous terms, and it opens the door to things that I don't think fit with an open internet, what we call net neutrality, an open internet that's been accessible to everyone, and that we don't have fast lanes, slow lanes, consumers picking up the tab. Where it really turns the internet on its head as we know it.
And how do you understand commercially reasonable?
Well, it's an excellent question. That would be the yardstick that has to have markers in it that the FCC would then measure proposals that come to it and whether they accept or reject them.
Now, why
and,
hasn't Congress...
So that's why it is so, it's troubling, deeply troubling.
Why doesn't Congress outline these clear rules so there's no confusion?
Well, that's another wonderful question.
and naive.
for the... I'm in the minority party in the House. Certainly the majority in the House have been on record ad nauseum in opposition to net neutrality. So they have no interest in it. They've made that very clear. In fact, they believe that net neutrality and open internet is... They don't agree with my view. Let's just put it that way. Why spend time going into it? So it,
right.
Their approach really is to let the companies do whatever they want to do, and that makes it free and open and accessible.
Democratic Congresswoman for Silicon Valley, Anna Eshoo. Joining us now, Sam Quest. He reports on the telecom industry for Business Etc., a new financial media platform. And I indeed did say BidNess. That is the name. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. And it is BidNessEtc.com.
Thanks very much, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, and others, as we just heard her say, think that the pay-to-play internet system is a bad idea. It goes against what many people refer to as net neutrality, the open flow without discrimination of data transmission. And other critics have also said it will stifle innovation from startups, and it will also stifle small businesses, that it would keep them from getting the global access they need to grow. I'll throw that all to you. What do you think of that?
Well, sure. Thanks. There's a couple of issues at hand here. There seems to be a lot of confusion as well as a lot of misinformation about what net neutrality actually means. So I'll take the first question as far as how it would affect a startup. A startup company right now and in any sort of proposed legislation that might come out of the FCC would not stifle any competition because it would not change any of the infrastructure that the internet currently operates on. So there are certain bandwidths that are available for all information. It is open and free and neutral, as the net neutrality obviously implies.
But wouldn't it put the control? Wouldn't it put the control of that infrastructure into corporate entities and to presumably serve their interests?
No, the actual proposal that is up that will come up for voting on May 15th will actually give the companies the ability between each other, let's say a content provider, as well as an ISP or a broadband company, the opportunity to strike deals, not to necessarily diminish the infrastructure as it exists now, but actually provide the companies with a faster lane, you can say, or a bandwidth that is specifically for their purposes. So if it implies that a company can spend the money to provide a user experience for their users or their subscribers, we don't necessarily feel that that is stifling the competition, because that competition can always and has always had the opportunity to operate in the environment in the current internet or the World Wide Web as it exists right now.
So you're saying that goes for small businesses too. Everybody would still have their internet and be paying for
correct.
It as they choose.
Yes, let's look at it this way. If I choose to fly on an airline and I choose to purchase a ticket on a first class, that does not diminish the ability for anybody else to fly on that airplane, in economy or anywhere else. So kind of going off that analogy, it's the same thing for these ISPs and these content providers. If they can come to agreement and they can choose to provide a certain sort of user experience to their subscribers, while they're willing to pay for it, we don't see the harm in that, because it does not diminish the infrastructure as it stands right now and the ability for startups to be able to operate in that environment. This is the environment that has existed for over 20 years, and this has allowed the internet to flourish so far. It hasn't allowed any of the bigger companies to stifle competition, and any of the new proposed legislation that might come out of the FCC is looking to do so. Any of the wording that has that has come out so far indicates that it would actually require more transparencies from the ISPs as far as what kind of bandwidth they're providing, as far as their infrastructure, so on and so forth. So we actually believe that it would make it more open for consumers and subscribers to make their decisions based on what the ISPs actually provide.
And would the two-tier system foster competition? On the other hand, on the positive side, would it foster competition with major telecom companies?
It could. I mean, look, the technology is evolving all the time. There's a lot of data content that seems to be spurring up out of everywhere, right? So at any given point during peak hours, Netflix and YouTube, essentially video streaming can account for 30 to 40% of the overall network capacity in Northern America. The point of the issue is who gets to pay for it. So a lot of net neutrality advocates would say right now that there is free and equal access, but in all reality, the companies, the data providers or the content producers are actually paying internet for internet access to subscribers. They technically pay tier one companies such as Cogent or L3 Communications the right to distribute their content to the masses.
Right.
The recent deal between Verizon that was just struck between Verizon and Netflix, as well as about a month ago, a deal was struck between Comcast and Netflix as well, actually just bypasses those tier one ISPs and makes a channel directly to the ISPs such as Comcast and Verizon. So it cuts out the middleman.
Sam Quest, give me a moment, reports on the telecom industry for business, etc.com, a new financial media platform. Gautam Nagesh is with the Wall Street Journal. I'd like you to comment on what we've heard so far. This is a complicated issue. Have you seen any red flags or out-and-out incorrect statements?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think Sam would refer to legislation. The FCC does not obviously deal in legislation. They are a regulatory agency. They have a proposed rulemaking. There is no net neutrality legislation, and the likelihood that Congress would weigh in on this is almost nothing as long as Congress remains divided, because it has become a highly partisan issue. When he refers to the level of the Internet, he is correct in that Chairman Wheeler has portrayed that the level of service that ISPs currently expect should not change. And he said today again in Los Angeles that if companies attempt to make traditional broadband service slower, which in theory would hurt startups and those sorts of companies, then the FCC is willing to step in and use whatever authority it can to ensure that doesn't happen. With that being said, advocates of net neutrality, I think, would argue that the mere presence that a company is able to pay for better service would, by its nature, constitute discrimination. For an example, this is mostly about video, because video is the most in-demand product right now for users over the Internet, and it also consumes the most bandwidth. If a user, let's say you pay your flat fee, $50 to $70 a month for broadband Internet access, and there are two video providers, one is a little bit choppy, especially at peak times, you know, in the evenings when everyone's watching on-demand video, and the other one, because they paid your broadband provider, comes through in HD quality, very clear, and maybe it doesn't even count against the data allowance that you're allowed by your broadband provider every month. Those are compelling reasons to some consumers why they would pick the first service, which would likely be the larger and more established service that can afford to pay. So that's just one example that this could affect competition.
Gautam Nagesh covers the FCC and tech policy for the Wall Street Journal. And when we come back from the break, we'll hear from a net neutrality advocate. And that's just in a minute as we continue our conversation. On our talking point today, Nigeria's lost girls. So stay tuned for that. This is To The Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the FCC's plan to create new rules for the Internet. The agency is proposing a two-tiered system that allows telecom giants like Comcast and Verizon to pay extra for faster data transmission of all of the good stuff we watch and hear and read on the web. Sam Quest is a reporter with Business Etc. He's a new financial, which is a new financial media platform. Also with us, we have Christopher Alley. He's assistant professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia and is a net neutrality advocate. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So are there other issues that you're concerned about than the ones we've been talking about so far on the show when that we'll hear from FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler when this this comes to a meeting? The FCC meets on May 15th.
Yeah, you know, well, we've been talking a lot and listening to the show. We've talked a lot about the concern for this for the two-tiered approach to the Internet, an approach that might start mimicking cable, for instance. And where my concerns really lay is coming from access to news and information. We keep demanding that newspapers and television stations, particularly at the local level, kind of step up their game in terms of digital media and online delivery systems. They're going to have an even tougher time doing so if they have to start paying for their videos and more enhanced content to load faster or to stream quicker. And so how will this potentially impact those struggling newspapers to deliver the local news and information that we need? And then how is this going to impact news and information startups? So I think this really has an impact on the news and information ecosystem of the United States.
Now, I know Sam Quest has some ideas about that from the financial media platform BusinessEtc.com, but I want to ask you one more question before we get into the debate. We've been talking all along about net neutrality, and it's not an easy thing to explain. So advocates like yourself say that this proposal that the FCC is putting forth is just a blow to the heart of net neutrality, which is what makes the Internet unique. Mm-hmm. So could you please explain that concept, that net neutrality isn't just an idea, but it is, as some people argue, the way the Internet works?
Well, the heart of net neutrality is that no company, no internet service provider, or no entity really should have control over the access to the content that we want to receive, that we should be able to stream our videos, to get our news, to make our Skype calls, to do all these wonderful things, to have these interconnections that the internet has allowed us to do, and that no company should be able to speed up a service or slow down a service in order to meet their particular market demands. So what this potentially creates is not so much the slowing down of a service, but as your guest from the Wall Street Journal noted, what happens if, Comcast, for instance, well, they may not slow down Netflix for a consumer, but what they might do is start speeding up a service that they own. So now we're starting to see these companies, these internet service providers, who are hugely powerful, controlling access to content, to news and information, and in effect having the capacity to start setting the agenda for political discussions in the country because they can start slowing down or speeding up access to certain sites. And again, this has to go back to ideas of ownership. So really when we're talking about the free access to information, which is of course a loaded term in and of itself, we have to think about how it is that that we have this access and who is it that's controlling these switches that speed up our service or start slowing it down. So this is really the heart of net neutrality.
And Christopher Alley, assistant professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. Sam Quest, reporter with BusinessEtc.com. I'd like your response to how Christopher Alley laid out the situation before the FCC and the people on the Internet.
Sure. So Chris raises some interesting points. At the beginning, I believe he mentioned the information access on a local level, and that, I will repeat my point from earlier in regards to how the infrastructure is right now and how it is proposed in the policy that the FCC is proposing coming up. So that infrastructure essentially is to remain the same. Nothing in there suggests that the FCC is asking for or any ISP or broadband provider will be asked to block or slow down any information or any kind of content from any specific content provider to any specific user. that infrastructure maintains itself. The only thing that differs in what is already in existence and what is being proposed is the opportunity between two companies, an ISP and a content provider, to come to an agreement to provide a different and an enhanced user experience for their subscriber base.
This is looking ahead and what could follow from these rules if the FCC goes down this path. Christopher Alley with the University of Virginia, could you elaborate?
Yeah, well, I think we have to remember here that communications infrastructure, telecommunications, mass media, media in general, are much different than any other industries because we are talking about the diffusion of ideas here. We're talking about the way in which people can start seeing the world and start forming opinions, start forming political opinions, and how we're educated as citizens and as consumers in a democracy. So I would respectfully disagree with the guest from Business because we cannot trust the market entirely to be able to provide for these kind of this kind of information, this kind of access, because we do need to recognize, as the FCC has done in the past in things like the access to the telephone system and access to over-the-air television and radio, that communications infrastructure are much different because of the social capacity to spread ideas and messages and meanings.
It is true, though, just to follow up on what Sam Quest was saying, that Tom Wheeler, the FCC commissioner, has said that these new rules mandate that these providers may not act in a commercially unreasonable manner to harm the Internet, including favoring the traffic from an affiliated entity, which is, I think, what you're talking about. But I should ask you to unpack that language, please, because advocates of net neutrality are very concerned about this.
Well, and this is one word that the FCC really loves to use, which is this word reasonable, because on the face of it, the word reasonable sounds, well, reasonable. Except the problem is that we don't actually have a definition of what the word reasonable or unreasonable means. And so this becomes highly problematic when we've got the FCC saying, you know, we're going to be watching out for deals that are commercially, or they need to make sure that deals are commercially reasonable. Well, who sets the barometer for what is reasonable? And the concern here is that it's going to be the companies themselves that are doing that. So you could have, you know, again, one of the major ISPs striking a deal with Facebook that might be reasonable in that situation, or with CNN, which might be reasonable in that situation. And then this becomes, again, market incentives versus, kind of regulatory oversight that public interest advocates would like to see a little bit stronger there.
And do you see a parallel between perhaps what goes on in journalism, keeping a firewall between editorial and management in order not to affect the content in a newspaper?
Well, definitely. So, you know, in the early debates over net neutrality, one of the major concerns was that Internet service providers wanted to start acting like newspapers. They wanted to start curating the content. So, you know, or rather a better analogy would be that Internet service providers wanted to start operating like cable systems. So, you know, they would set what a basic tier is, and then they would set, you know, cable companies get to pick and choose what services they offer, just like Internet service providers would like to be able to pick and choose what services they offer. So, you know, I'll use an example of Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera really struggled getting on cable systems here in the country, and now Internet service providers would like to, you know, curate the Internet experience just like cable companies curate our television experience.
Christopher Alley teaches media studies at the University of Virginia. Christopher Mitchell is director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So while this whole debate is going on about the FCC's proposed rules, what's going on the local level with municipalities and creating community networks?
Well, it's interesting because we have this opportunity at the federal level to regulate, and it seems that we may be missing that opportunity to guarantee that everyone has the access that they need at home on the terms that they need it. So an alternative is for local governments to actually build networks. And we're tracking at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance over 400 local governments that are providing some level of service to local businesses and residents. So that means in some cities you may get your electricity from your city, over 2,000 cities in the United States. Well, there's 400 cities in the United States where you could get Internet access sometimes also cable television or telephone service from your local government.
And what effect might the FCC's rules have on community broadband?
Well, the FCC's rules would apply to everyone. Local governments have to follow the same laws as the private companies. So we'd like to see strong regulation to make sure that we don't see paid prioritization and any sorts of violations of network neutrality. But the thing about the local governments is that when the community owns the network, even if the FCC isn't mandating those kinds of regulations, local governments can follow them. So I would suggest that the whole issue around network neutrality arises from a few massive companies like your big cable companies that are really trying to increase their profits at the expense of communities and the people in the communities and local businesses. When the network's owned locally, often by a small company or by the local government itself or of some form of cooperative, you don't have that same incentive. They're just trying to provide good services. You know, one way to think of it is that if everyone gets a fast lane, then there's no reason to try and sell a faster lane because a lot of local governments have these super fast fiber networks that are deliver far higher speeds than you can get from the cable and telephone companies.
Well, moving forward, how, though, can these local municipalities, local companies compete with the big lobbying dollars of for instance, some of these huge telecom giants who might be working on who might have a two-tiered system in the future?
Well, this is the challenge. In fact, the largest threat, I think, to municipal networks is the lobbying dollars of these big companies. They've convinced 19 states already to create barriers to local governments even having the ability to decide whether to build these networks. But this is something where the FCC is actually acting very strongly in favor of the public interest. And Chairman Wheeler today reiterated that the FCC is going to be removing some of these barriers. And so even as we're seeing the FCC acting in ways that are beneficial to these big carriers with regards to not upholding network neutrality as high as we'd like, we're seeing the FCC acting to make sure that these big companies cannot bar their competition from communities.
Christopher Mitchell is director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative for Local Self-Reliance. And also joining us is, or back to Christopher Alley. He is with the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. Is it possible, though, as we move forward, that we could have a system where there's we have both faster speed and limited data?
Well, you know, and this is again a very important concern. We're seeing more and more caps on data usage, so faster speeds, but data caps is an incentive for people to go over their data and to start paying more. So, for instance, you know, we've already heard how much bandwidth Netflix uses, for instance, and particularly in the evenings, you know, after work, bandwidth spikes as people watch Netflix. But if we're getting, you know, faster speeds, which is fantastic, which is really what we want, but we start seeing data caps, then people are going to start, or consumers rather, are going to start seeing their bills increase dramatically.
But everyone's very, very frustrated about the congestion, too, at the same time. So what's the solution?
Absolutely. Well, I think the solution right now, in particular for net neutrality, we need to have a more spirited discussion about this. We need to really open up the conversation and allow people, not just internet service providers or even large edge providers like Google or Facebook or Netflix, but I think we actually have to be having an honest conversation about the way in which we want the future of the internet to look in the United States. And I think that we really need to start taking some lessons from what's going on in other countries. What's going on in the European Union, for instance, which has passed net neutrality regulations, or looking at, for instance, the broadband infrastructure of a country like South Korea. So I really think that there are lessons that we can be learning, both from consumers and from abroad.
Well, there is a larger question here also of free speech and concern that the internet, in which faster content transmission goes to the highest bidder among virtual monopolies, that's one, the net neutrality argument, that it could hamper free speech. Play that argument out for us, please.
Well, the idea is that if you've got these large companies, these large internet service providers that are offering the fast lane to the highest bidders, Well, then what does that do, again, for, let's say, a local news startup that has a view to offer that should be part of this marketplace of ideas and this diversity of voices that we want to be championing in our news and information ecosystem, and they can't afford the faster speeds? Well, in the same way that, you know, if I have a video service that's going to buffer for 5 seconds or 5 minutes and I have another service that's not, I'm going to go to the service that's faster. Same thing can happen with news and information, where you can start seeing, you know, startups or small news organizations that are just being priced out of the market because they just can't compete with those super fast loading, super flashy enhanced services that some of the larger companies can afford. And this becomes a question then for news, information, and democracy.
Christopher Alley of University of Virginia. Christopher Mitchell also is with us. He's director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative. Christopher Alley was just mentioning Europe. Any of us who have traveled know how fast the internet is in other countries. The U.S. is reportedly one of the slowest. So why is the internet in the U.S. so slow and compared to the rest of the world? And what is there to learn from other countries?
Well, the internet in the United States is indeed slower than many other industrialized countries. We're not sort of the slowest on earth, certainly. But I think the area that of the biggest concern is our metro areas really lag behind the metro areas of many other areas of Europe and Asia in particular. And the reason for that is because our policies coming out of Washington, D.C. around telecom have largely been crafted by the cable and telephone companies themselves. We have poor policy that's allowed them to basically monopolize the industry to their liking, whereas in other countries, the policies are written by people who take this very seriously and consider the public interest. They require competition, and in some cases, they'll subsidize the networks in ways that we have not, although we certainly subsidize privately owned networks quite a bit. So I would say that the short answer is that there's smarter government policies in those areas that are resulting in more investment in faster networks, wired networks in particular, that allow all of the local businesses to thrive in ways that many of our local businesses are struggling with.
Christopher Mitchell, director of the Community Broadband Networks and an advocate for local broadband. Also with us today was Sam Quest, a reporter for BusinessEtc.com, Christopher Alley of University of Virginia, and Gautam Nagesh, who covers the FCC for The Wall Street Journal, also Democratic Congresswoman Anna Eshoo. Thank you to all of you. In a moment, Islamic militants kidnapped more than 200 girls from a school in Nigeria more than 2 weeks ago. The military still hasn't succeeded in rescuing them. And meanwhile, the government doesn't seem to even know where they are. We talk with a reporter who spoke with their parents, Nigeria's lost girls. That's today's Talking Point after the break. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're back with our Talking Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Warren Olney on To The Point. A little more than 2 weeks ago, a Nigerian militant group known as Boko Haram kidnapped over 200 girls from a state school in the northern part of the country. So far, the government hasn't been able to rescue these teenagers. Now there are rumors of mass marriages of the girls to their captors. And this is just one of a series of attacks on schools and villages over the past 5 years of insurgency in the region. Alexis Okewo is a freelance journalist based in Lagos. She's been covering the crisis for The New Yorker's blog, and she joins us today. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first, could you tell us about the kidnapping? How did that go down a little over 2 weeks ago?
Yes, well, what happened is that currently most of the schools in the Northeast are closed because of the fact that, as you said, Boko Haram has been attacking many schools. In February, they attacked a school and killed 59 schoolboys. But the officials in the town of Chibok decided to briefly reopen the secondary school there so that the girls could sit and take their final exams. However, one night, Boko Haram showed up dressed in military uniforms and kidnapped the girls, and they took them into the bush. And ever since that happened, the parents have not heard from them since.
And this is in a remote area? correct? With a wooded, very wooded, very inaccessible?
Yes, exactly. Basically, this is a remote area. It's near the Sambisa Forest, which is a huge swath of forested land near the border with Cameroon and Chad. And it's very remote, very sparsely populated.
So what do we know about how they're being treated?
Well, all we have now are eyewitness reports. And what parents in Chibok are hearing now is that villagers have seen trucks pass with the girls. And then we've now heard that the parents heard from eyewitnesses that these girls were potentially married to several of the militants. And so we can only imagine the kind of things they're being forced to do. Some of the girls who have escaped have said they were forced to cook, clean, fetch water and firewood, and do other types of tasks for the men.
Obviously, the parents must be going out of their minds with worry at this point. What were they telling you?
Yes, I mean, there were some parents I spoke to who just couldn't speak. They were so upset and so disappointed by the government. They felt failed. There were other parents who were just devastated. They had tried themselves to go search for their girls. It was too dangerous. One parent told me that some of the parents were falling physically ill and that other parents were going mad, he said.
Just a terrible situation. And there seems to be some confusion about who knows what and how trustworthy the government is in Nigeria, right? A day after the kidnapping, the military announced it had rescued nearly all of these girls. And then the next day they retracted that. What is going on there?
Yes. The day after the kidnapping, the military said they had rescued nearly all of the girls. And then without explanation, they then said that it was a mistake. So it's been very confusing because the parents have not heard anything from the military since. The spokesman said that the search was intense and ongoing, but since eyewitnesses have reported knowing or seeing where the militants are, it's confusing as to why the military has not gone in and actually recovered any of the girls. In fact, many Nigerians are wondering if the military is actually conducting an operation right now to recover the girls.
And is that indicative of how much distrust there is, or what are they basing that on?
Yes, there's a lot of distrust because, I mean, as you mentioned, these attacks have been ongoing for 5 years. And in the past, people have been abducted and killed, and there's not been a sufficient, Nigerians feel, a sufficient action taken by the military to stop these attacks. And so especially after the military, you know, has not captured any of the girls 2 weeks on, there's a lot of distrust.
Now, what's known about Boko Haram, this militant group, and why they're attacking schools and these remote villages in northern Nigeria?
Well, Boko Haram was started over a decade ago by a radical Islamist preacher who basically said that he was tired of political corruption in Nigeria and he wanted to return to a pure Islamic society. So he started this group, and this group over time became more radical. It started taking up affiliations with offshoots of Al-Qaeda and now says it's waging a jihad. And this jihad has been waged on secular values, part of that which is Western education, hence the attacks on the schools. But it's also now difficult to comprehend what now is their specific goal. They're just waging a huge amount of violence on the Northeast, on villagers, on innocent people. So it's difficult to know what exactly they want right now, besides just creating fear and terror.
And this in this whole region, there's been intense fighting, correct, between Boko Haram and Nigerian forces. How well is the government handling the whole situation?
Yes. I mean, when the Nigerian government placed much of the Northeast last year under a state of emergency, Nigerians were happy that the government was finally launching an intense operation to root out and defeat the militants. But it now seems that the government is not really winning the war. It claims that it's defeating all these terrorists, but yet attacks happen week after week, sometimes multiple times in a week. So it's really hard to know if the Nigerian government is winning or not. It doesn't seem so right now.
And is there a suspicion that the government is maybe turning a blind eye or giving up?
Well, I think for a long time they turned a blind eye. And I think right now it's a matter of of wondering if they're actually now going to really dedicate the time and the focus onto it, because that hasn't happened in the past.
So what hope is there for a safe rescue of these girls?
I think that there's hope. I mean, I think one thing we can be somewhat sure of is that these girls have not been killed. I mean, what is discouraging is that it is possible these girls have been taken over the border into remote towns, into Cameroon and Chad, and possibly married off. But I think if the military come up with a smart plan, it could still be possible to rescue these girls.
And I understand Nigerian women are planning to rally in support of them. What are the plans?
Exactly. There is a large protest today with hundreds of people in the capital, Abuja, and they said that they will protest every day until they hear something from the government on what it plans to do to get these girls.
Freelance journalist Alexis Okewo, thank you so much. And just one last question.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you speak to one of the girls who had escaped? What did she tell you?
I did. Well, she was very traumatized and just and a brave girl, and she said that, you know, when she was captured, she just felt like she knew she had a short window to get out and to escape, but now she's tormented by the fact that her cousins and her close friends are still there. And she said that all she's doing is praying and fasting and thinking of them. I mean, it's a lot of survivor's guilt. She's feeling very tormented.
And does she have services to help her recover?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there aren't really that many psychological services up there. I mean, what she has is family and an extended community that I hope is supporting her.
Thank you again. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Freelance journalist Alexis Okewo. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.